Srimad Bhagavad Gita. This is chapter 13 entitled Nature, the Enjoyer and the Consciousness. Text 20 and 21. So we'll read text 20. Kindly repeat after me. Prakritim purusham chaiva viddhi anadi ubhavapi viddhi anadi ubhavapi vikaramscha gunamschaiva ramscha gunamschaiva viddhi prakriti sambhavan viddhi prakriti sambhavan. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Translation: the material nature and the living entities should be understood to be beginningless. Their transformations and the modes of matter are products of material nature. Purport: by the knowledge given in this chapter, one can understand the body, the field of activities, and the knower of the body, both the individual soul and the super soul. The body is the field of activity and is composed of material nature. The individual soul that is embodied and enjoying the activities of the body is called the Purusha or the living entity. He is one knower and the other is the super soul. Of course, it is to be understood that both the super soul and the individual entity are different manifestations of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The living entity is in the category of his energy and the super soul is in the category of his personal expansion. Both material nature and living entity are eternal. That is to say that they existed before the creation. The material manifestation is from the energy of the Supreme Lord, and so also are the living entities. But the living entities are of the superior energy. Both the living entities and material nature existed before this cosmos was manifested. Material nature was absorbed in the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Mahavishnu, and when it was required, it was manifested by the agency of the Mahatattva. Similarly, the living entities are also in him, and because they are conditioned, they are averse to serving the Supreme Lord. Thus, they are not allowed to enter into the spiritual sky. But with the coming forth of material nature, those living entities are again given a chance to act in the material world and prepare themselves to enter into the spiritual world. That is the mystery of this material creation. Actually, the living entity is originally the spiritual part and parcel of the Supreme Lord. But due to his rebellious nature, he is conditioned within the material nature. It really does not matter how the living entities or superior entities of the Supreme Lord have come in contact with material nature. The Supreme Personality of Godhead knows, however, how and why this actually took place. In the scriptures, the Lord says that those attracted by this material nature are undergoing a hard struggle for existence. But we should know it with certainty from the descriptions of these few verses that all transformation and influences of material nature by the three modes are also productions of material nature. All transformations and variety in respect to living entities are due to the body. As far as the spirit is concerned, the living entities are all the same. Om Agyanti Mirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. We welcome all of you all to this evening Bhagavad Gita class. Today's class, today's evening is specially relevant and important since this is the eve before which the Bhagavad Gita was spoken. Bhagavad Gita was spoken 5000 years before on the Tithi which is appearing tomorrow. And today is the previous evening, very special, and especially if we meditate and focus on what is the relevance of Bhagavad Gita in our lives, it definitely will help us to absorb ourselves and to be in the right spirits and consciousness tomorrow on the day of Gita Jayanti. And tomorrow we are having a special yagya also, so whoever is interested can participate and benefit from this. So here in this 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, which is called Nature, Enjoyer and Consciousness, the theme that is taken up by Lord Krishna here specifically is that both the material nature and the living entities are eternal. So we find that how can both things which are eternal be actually existing simultaneously together? And what is this concept of material nature which is temporary and living entity which is eternal? The right understanding is that which is presented by Krishna in the Gita. The material nature, though it is eternal creation of the Lord, but its manifestations are temporary. And the living entity, which is again an eternal creation of the Lord, its manifestation is permanent. In the sense that the living entity is not annihilated, the living entity does not merge and lose its existence, but its living entity is also eternal. Both are the creations of the Lord. But the difference is that the material nature is actually constantly transforming itself into different varieties. But the living entity is not changing its form, its nature. And the interesting part is that at the end of creation, both the material nature and the living entity are absorbed back into the Lord. The description in the Gita is that the Lord, who is the Mahavishnu, who is a huge gigantic form, every pore on the body of the Lord, like all of us have so many pores on the skin, and these pores for us are nothing significant, nothing significant about the pores. But the pores of the Lord are very special, they're very significant, because every pore of the Lord, where generally the sweat glands are situated, where sweat comes out from our body. But for the Lord, every pore is capable of holding and absorbing the whole universe. That's how huge and gigantic the Lord is. So it is described that when the Lord inhales, when he breathes inside, all millions and millions of universes are taken into his body, into every pore. In every pore, the universes enter. And when the Lord exhales, the universes are emitted out of the body of the Lord. So that's just to give an understanding of how gigantic the Lord is. But not just that, not just the universes are absorbed into the Lord, but also all the living entities are absorbed into the Lord. And the interesting part is that when the material nature and the living entities come out of the Lord, that is a chance, that's where the difference lies. Material nature does not have a chance to go back to God. It does not have a chance to perfect its existence. But the living entity, who is the superior energy of the Lord, gets a chance to go back to the spiritual world, to go back to God. It. Now the question is, if we are parts and parcels of God, if we are all just like the Lord in quality, then why are we here? Why are we rejected from the spiritual world? Why are we here? That's the question. The answer that is given in the Gita, specifically in this verse, is that because of the rebellious nature of the living entity is destined and made to come here, to come to the material world, to try to perfect its life. So let us not focus on why we are here. Let us not focus on why we fell down. Let us focus on how we can actually elevate ourselves to go back to the spiritual world. So one concept that is described in this verse specifically is the concept of the living entity coming in contact with material nature. What is the meaning of a living entity coming in contact with material nature? Just to make us understand this concept better, let us take the example of a prison house. If you see a prison, in the same prison, different kinds of criminals are accommodated. And depending on the crime and depending on their level of ferociousness or consciousness, they are given different facilities. Like some criminals are really hardcore criminals. They are put in solitary prisons. That means they can't see anybody else. Nobody can see them. And the food is just pushed into the door. Solitary confinement, it's called. Some prisoners are put in congestion. That means 10 people are put in one cell. Or some people are made monitors of other prisoners. One prisoner, he's in charge for 10 more prisoners. So like that. So now the understanding is, either you are in solitary confinement,
or you are, you know, pushed with many people, or you are in charge of many people. Either ways, in all three ways, the fact is that they are prisoners. So the material world, just because we have a different facility to enjoy, just because we have a different aspect or different relationship with the world, it doesn't mean that we are special. The fact that we are in this world is that we are questionable. So we should not ask for a different position in the prison, but we should rather ask the question, why are we in the prison? So that's the basic concept that Bhagavad Gita wants us to ask. Why are we here, first of all? So we shouldn't be delving into this concept of why we fell down, but we should be delving into the concept of why we are here and how we can get out from here. Just like in the material world, the promises are made of different aspects, and you feel that this is actually giving some kind of enjoyment. For example, in New York, one of our devotees, he saw a board, you know, billboard, which is written, get out of the hustle and bustle of New York City and go to Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico is an island. You know. So it recommends, go to Puerto Rico. It's travel agent recommending. And then when you actually go to Puerto Rico, this devotee is mentioning that there is a board, go to New York City to enjoy. So the point is, wherever you are in this material world, whichever situation of life you may be in, it's another aspect or it's another situation which is changing. As we say, the grass is always green on the other side. Right? So, for somebody who is on this side, he might find the other side more interesting. But from somebody who is on the other side, he might find this side more interesting. So, the point is from which side you are seeing. But both situations are similarly problematic. Or for example, if you... The entanglement or staying in the material world is just like handling tar or coal. If you touch coal, tar coal, you know they call it. If you touch it, it sticks in your hand. But if you think that you can relieve the sticking by another sticking, you use your other hand to remove it, then it sticks in this hand also. Then you can use a leg, it'll stick in your leg also. Use the other leg, it'll stick. So basically you are completely stuck. So the understanding is that when we are a part of this material world, using a concept of this material world to elevate is always going to push us down or is always going to entangle us more. So we have to use a concept that is beyond this world. We have to use a concept that is unaffected by this world. So that's the concept of the Gita. So the Gita talks about the next verse, text 21, we'll just read it quickly. Karaya karane kartritve hetu prakritir uchyate purusha sukha dukkam nam bhoktritva hetu uchyate. The nature is said to be the cause of all material causes and effects, whereas the living entity is the cause of various sufferings and enjoyments in this world. So the point is that everyone is struggling to acquire different pleasures in this world. Everyone is trying to, you know, different means of enjoying in this world. But the point is that every different means of enjoyment gives us a different kind of a body. Basically, all the bodies that are there in this material world are actually according to one's past desires and activities. If you see a germ growing in a stale food, when you see food, you know, you store it in an empty jar. Even if you store it in the jar for many days, germs come. Even if there is no air, you know, you don't allow the germs to come. Automatically germs generate. So even that germ which generates is a living entity. And the reason that it is there in that particular place, in that stale food, is because in its past life, in its past, it had a desire to enjoy in a certain way. So Krishna reciprocates with his desire and gives it the facility. So, as I was saying, we should use a technology or a concept to elevate ourselves from the material world, which is not a part of this material world. The concept has to be different. So, Bhagavad Gita is the concept which actually can help us to elevate ourselves from this world. And Krishna has given this Bhagavad Gita in a very, very interesting and very practical manner. Just like if you see two people talking, two great people talking. So when two great people talk, the talk is always of importance, or it is always of relevance to everybody else. Just like, for example, the Prime Minister of India and the President of the United States, they come and meet and they have a meeting and they talk. So is that talk not of relevance and consequence to the entire world? Naturally, it is of some relevance and some consequence. So just imagine Krishna, who is actually the proprietor, controller and the enjoyer of the entire universe, of all the worlds, is talking to his disciple, to Arjun. So is that talk not of any relevance to us? Is that talk not of any significance to us? The fact that just because we are not able to directly relate to it, because we don't have the right teacher, doesn't mean that the talk is irrelevant. The talk is definitely relevant. So that's what the concept of Gita Jayanti is. And the place in which the talk was made makes it even more relevant. Because when the most crucial point of time is there, you will not talk rubbish. Right? Just for example, if a student is entering the examination hall, just 2 minutes left for the bell to ring. So at that point of time, will the student talk about anything else other than the subject matter? Or will he talk of any nonsense? Or will he talk about movies? No, because the most crucial thing is going to happen now. The whole year's preparation is going to be tested now. Similarly, in the battle of Kurukshetra, when the two armies had gathered together and they were in front of each other, and just one moment away, the fight is going to start. Anything that happens at that point of time naturally is of most crucial and most important consequence to both the sides, and in fact to the entire world. So Bhagavad Gita was spoken at that point of time. So Krishna did not choose to speak the Bhagavad Gita at that point of time because he never had time with Arjun any other time. He chose to speak at that point of time because that was the most crucial moment in Arjun's life and the most crucial moment in the life of practically the entire planet. So if we think that Bhagavad Gita is relevant to us only when we become old or only when we don't have anything to do in this life, then we are wrong. Because that means we have not actually analyzed when Bhagavad Gita was spoken. So Bhagavad Gita was spoken in the midst of the most important situation in life. And the conversation itself was of the greatest gravity. So the Bhagavad Gita actually is something which is a talk between two great personalities, and which is definitely of consequence to our lives, and which will definitely help our lives. And anything spoken, however small or however big, between great people is important. Just like Krishna spoke the Chatushtloki Bhagavatam to Brahmaji. He only spoke 4 verses. And those 4 verses of the Bhagavad, which Krishna spoke to Brahmaji, have actually been expanded by Vyasadeva and Shukadeva Goswami into 18,000 verses. So that means what Krishna spoke to Brahma is actually the essence of the essence of the essence of all knowledge. So similarly, what Krishna is speaking to Arjun in the Bhagavad Gita, which is apparently just 700 verses, is actually the essence of the essence of the essence of the entire Vedic scriptures, the gamut of which is almost 1 lakh verses, unlimited. One verse itself could take us a lifetime to understand and actually digest. But just imagine 1 lakh verses, which will be almost impossible for us to understand, and what to speak of actually even going through it. So Krishna, out of his compassion and out of his mercy, chose to speak and condense the whole essence of the scriptures into these 700 verses of the Gita. And actually, when the acharyas or the great spiritual masters take up these 700 verses, they actually analyze it and present it to us in something that most palatable and most easy for us to relate to. So the Acharyas explained that the Bhagavad Gita is condensed into the threefold types of yoga. That means the entirety of the Bhagavad Gita can be in three concepts. It's called the threefold yoga. The concept of the Karma Yoga, the concept of Jnana Yoga, and the concept of Bhakti Yoga. And we'll see how interestingly this concept, these three things which Krishna explains to Arjun, is actually something that will satisfy us completely. Not just ourselves, but the entire world. We'll see how it happens. So Karma Yoga, or which is actually called activity or profession, is a combination of is supported by spiritual knowledge and it is inspired by devotion to God. Karma Yoga, though apparently it is an activity, many people think Karma Yoga, karma means action. Work is worship, many people think. But apparently the Bhagavad Gita has a different explanation of Karma Yoga and a different relevance of Karma Yoga. Karma Yoga is considered to be activity or work, profession, but it is combined by spiritual knowledge and it is inspired by devotion to God. So this is what Karma Yoga is, combination of both. And the perfect example of somebody who is practicing Karma Yoga to the best is Janak Maharaj. And we will see one story in Janak Maharaj's life where we understand how he actually was the perfection of Karma Yoga. Because he was a king. He was no ordinary person. King means responsibility. Leader means responsibility. So any person who's having a responsible post is a leader. So all of us in our lives personally have some important responsibilities to execute. So we are leaders to some extent, whatever extent we may be. So Janak Maharaj was actually an ideal leader. And though he was perfection in his activity of Karma Yoga, but still he had devotion and he had the understanding of spiritual knowledge. There's a story in his life which will explain to us this concept. One day there was a Brahmana who used to come regularly to Janak Maharaj's kingdom, to palace, to recite from the verses of the Bhagavatam. And Janak Maharaj would attentively hear. So many people would think that this Brahmana is coming just to get money from Janak Maharaj. So many people would think that the Brahmana is coming only to get money from Janak Maharaj. So then one day they decided to test. And just to, prove. And this Brahmana actually wanted to prove to all these people that I'm not just come for money, but I've come because Janak Maharaj has the devotion in him, which I want to help him by reciting the Bhagavatam. So it so happened that when this Brahmana, he was reciting, he was waiting for Janak Maharaj. Janak Maharaj came in and the Brahmana started reciting the scriptures. Janak Maharaj is absorbed in hearing from the scriptures. And at some point of time, one man came running into the palace, into the king's court, and he announced that the king's treasury is on fire. So anything valuable for a person, naturally, if it is getting destroyed, it will affect him significantly. But Janak Maharaj was so absorbed in hearing the Bhagavatam, in hearing the scriptures, that he did not actually react. He just continued hearing. So of course the Brahmana continued reciting. And then after some time, another man came and informed that from the treasury, the fire has jumped into the houses of all the ministers. So as soon as the ministers heard this, they immediately ran away to take care of the houses. But Janak Maharaj and this Brahmana continued to sit and hear the Bhagavatam. So absorption is something that is not, that can't be imitated. That can't be, imitated. So Janak Maharaj was not only an ideal king, but he was somebody who was absorbed in knowledge of the scriptures and in practical devotion to God. So that is the first concept that the Gita explains about Karma Yoga. Action being supported by spiritual knowledge and inspired by devotion to God. And the second concept that the Gita explains is that of knowledge or gyan, which is knowledge of the self. But this knowledge again has two additions to it. The two additions are, the knowledge has to be sustained by life-fulfilling activities, and it has to be filled with devotion. Otherwise, this knowledge is not of any use. So the ideal example of this kind of knowledge is Jadabharat, whose story comes in the Bhagavatam. So Jadabharat was actually the reincarnation of Bharat Maharaj, and in this particular form, he actually took birth in the house of a Brahmana. And when his father and mother died, he was handed over to his stepmother to take care of. And they ill-treated him. But Jadabharat was situated in knowledge, in gyan. So he had knowledge of himself. He had understanding that he is not the body but is the spirit soul. And he had understanding of what his relationship is with Krishna. And he acted on that understanding. So he not only had knowledge, but he led a life filled with activities based on that knowledge and filled with devotion to God. So this was Jadabharat. So at one point of time, his stepmother told him to take care of a field, and Jadabharat was taking care. And suddenly some dacoits came and they attacked him, caught him and took him to the temple of Kali. They wanted to, kind of offer him as a sacrifice to Mother Kali. So here is something interesting for us. So Mother Kali represents material nature, and Jadabharat represents the devotee of the Lord, and the dacoits represent a living entity's tendency to enjoy or to exploit God's resources for one's own enjoyment. So when Jadabharat was taken to the prison, to this temple of Mother Kali, and he was actually going to be cut, his head was going to be chopped as a sacrifice to Kali. So just then, the weapons which were going to be used to kill him, those weapons raised out of the hands of the dacoits. And they actually came and severed the hands and legs of the dacoits themselves. So here is an interesting lesson that we can learn from this. Many times we meddle with material nature. We think that certain things can be used for our enjoyment, and we meddle with nature. Especially we meddle with devotion to God. And then material nature reacts back to us. And then when it reacts back to us in the form of tsunami, in the form of earthquakes, in so many ways, then we always ask this question, why it is attacking me? I was thinking of doing benefit for it. But we don't understand that what we think is benefit for material nature is actually maybe harmful. For example, slaughtering of cows. Or for example, so many plastic wastages to material nature. So many other aspects we treat material nature in a way. So this is an example where Mother Kali, who represents material nature, is telling us a lesson, teaching us a lesson, that if we treat the devotees of the Lord, or if we treat things that are dear to Krishna in a way that is very bad, so then material nature will react and we have to face the consequences. So this is the second aspect of gyan or knowledge of the self. And the third aspect that the Gita teaches us is bhakti or devotion, which is sustained again by two principles. Devotion sustained on activity and based on knowledge. So here bhakti is not talking about just blind faith. Here the principle of bhakti is based on activity. Bhakti doesn't mean inaction. Bhakti doesn't mean laziness. But bhakti means action. But not just any action. It is action filled with knowledge. Backed up with knowledge. So if anybody is talking about the concept of blind following or blind faith, that's not what is recommended in the Gita. Gita recommends faith but with knowledge. And the perfection or the epitome of an example of this kind of a faith is Prahlad Maharaj, who represents natural faith in God, whose faith is called Naishkargikim. The Bhagavatam mentions Prahlad Maharaj's faith as Naishkargikim. That means his faith was so natural to God that it didn't have to depend on any external things. He had natural faith. Just like the example is given that Prahlad Maharaj himself mentions how his attraction to God is so natural. So it's just like when you keep a magnet and you keep iron filings in front of the magnet. So is there an endeavor on the part of the iron filings to come to the magnet? There is absolutely no endeavor. The iron filings are attracted to the magnet naturally. So that's the way Prahlad Maharaj's devotion was attracted to God naturally. And that's the kind of devotion we need to cultivate. And if we have faith and we practice this kind of a devotion, then that devotion will actually help us in our lives. Just like Prahlad Maharaj, he had this devotion which was so natural that when he was even offered poison, he accepted it as something that is given by, which is actually the prasad or the remnants of the Lord. And when he took poison in this mood, the poison turned into nectar. So again, consciousness is important. Like if you analyze this pastime of where Lord Shiva was drinking the ocean of poison. You know, many people, all of us know this episode. Why Lord Shiva is called Neelakant? His throat is blue in color. Because he drank the poison that came out from the ocean. Halahal. And interestingly, when Shiva was drinking the poison which came out from the ocean, and few droplets of the poison, you know, poisonous substance were falling on the ground. And small living entities like the snakes and scorpions, these came and started drinking that poison. So in one sense, if you analyze it, they were drinking the Mahaprasad, the remnants of Shiva. But what are the consciousness in which they were drinking it? They were drinking it thinking that it is something that is going to nourish them. They were drinking it in a very negative consciousness. These people, these living entities, the snakes, reptiles and snakes and scorpions, these are actually representing the nature of envy of a living entity. So when these living entities were drinking this poison or the Mahaprasad of Shiva in this mood, they naturally became poisonous. So the poison remained poison. And the poison became harmful. And the poison could create ill effects. But when Prahlad Maharaj drank poison which was given to him by his father Hiranyakashipu, that poison actually turned into nectar. Because of the consciousness. Or for example, the other side, Rahu, the demon who drank nectar, which was got after the churning of the milk ocean. But when he drank the nectar, what happened? Mohini Murthy became Vishnu. And she cut off the head of Rahu. So he drank nectar, but he lost his life. And Lord Shiva, he drank poison, but he became glorified as Neelakant. So ultimately, the way you use what you are given is the consciousness in which you use it is how the thing reciprocates with you. So Prahlad Maharaj, he represents something which is uncompromising and a natural attraction to God. And Prahlad Maharaj's attraction to God is compared to the Chataka bird. The Chataka bird is a bird which only drinks water which comes down directly from the clouds. Directly from the clouds. It doesn't drink anything that is fallen on the ground. It's natural. So, speaking of, you know, the quality of water, you know, many people are conscious of what quality of water to drink. So, Chataka bird has the highest quality. So the point is, these three levels of yoga are explained in the Bhagavad Gita. The concept of Karma Yoga, which is action, but filled with devotion and filled with knowledge. And the Jnana Yoga, which is knowledge of the self, but again, filled with action and with devotion. And the third is Bhakti Yoga, which is devotion to God, which is again sustained on action, on activity, and informed of the knowledge. So this concept is unique in the Gita. So many people think that by reading Bhagavad Gita or taking shelter of God, we become useless to society, or we become having a lack of action in life. So this concept of Gita fulfills all three: duty to the world, which is Karma Yoga or action; duty to oneself, which is Jnana Yoga or knowledge; and duty to God, which is Bhakti Yoga or devotion. So Bhagavad Gita is not just a concept which is limited, but which is actually unlimited. So if we use this knowledge of the Gita, then the whole Gita makes a lot of sense. So tomorrow we will be also analyzing the entire Gita. Many speakers like Govind Prabhu, Gaurwal Prabhu will be speaking on different aspects of the Gita. Every chapter will be explained in summary, and we'll get a very clear understanding of what the Gita teaches us. So the interesting part is Krishna is a very special kind of a person, and he fulfills multiple roles in every incarnation of his, and he does multiple things in every action that he does. So we just try to analyze in brief different roles that Krishna played while incarnating on this earth, and you know, the kind of revolution that he created on this earth. So the different roles of Krishna are, the first role is that he was a revolutionary. He established dharma, or he established the truth. And to establish the truth, revolution means, you know, any kind of action, whatever is needed to establish the truth is to be done. So Krishna used so much tactics, diplomacy, he used so many things to actually bring out the truth in front. Just like, interestingly, in the beginning of the war of the Mahabharata, where just before the war was going to begin, and Krishna had actually solved Arjuna. He had spoken to Bhagavad Gita and Arjuna's doubts were cleared and he was ready. But then something interesting happened. Yudhishthira Maharaj gets down from his chariot and he starts walking. He keeps his bow and arrow down and he starts walking towards the Kaurava army. He walks straight to Bhishma Dev, and he's never consulted anybody. He never consulted his brothers that I'm going to do this. He never informed them. He just walked. And naturally, the brothers were obedient and they were trusting. They had faith in Yudhishthira Maharaj's actions. So they waited for him to do. But Bhima, being very inquisitive, and he wanted the war to happen. So he decided that he will go and follow Yudhishthira Maharaj and see what he does. And if he does something wrong, I'll stop him. So he follows Yudhishthira Maharaj. And Arjun, Nakul, Sahadev, all of them start following Yudhishthira Maharaj. And Yudhishthira Maharaj approaches Bhishma Dev. And then the whole battlefield is waiting to watch what Yudhishthira Maharaj is going to do. Is he going to ask for a compromise? Or is he going to say that I give up? The whole world was waiting to watch. And then Yudhishthira Maharaj touched the feet of Bhishma Dev and took his blessings. And Bhishma Dev told him that if you had not come here, I would have cursed you. But because you have come here, I give you the blessings that you all will be victorious. So that point of time, Krishna never accompanied the Pandavas to Bhishma Dev. But he was doing something else. So just see, this is the revolutionary personality of Godhead. He went to Karna. Karna was actually not participating in the war because he had taken a vow that as long as Bhishma Dev is on the battlefield fighting, I will not fight. So Karna was doing some kind of backstage services. He was taking care of supplies, he was taking care of, you know, other requirements for the army. Though he was a warrior because of the vow. So Krishna went to Karna and he told Karna, let's see, you are a Kshatriya. And Kshatriya has to fight. You can't be doing this kind of activity. You can't be doing supplies. And that's not your role. You should fight. So he said, I have a proposal for you. He said that if you have decided not to fight for the Kauravas, come and fight for the Pandavas till Bhishma is alive. And once Bhishma dies, you can go back. So just see, Karna was completely bewildered. He never expected this kind of a proposal ever. Somebody will come and ask him to come and fight for the Pandavas. It is too much for him. So Krishna, the point I'm trying to make is that Krishna was a revolutionary. He was ready to go to any extent provided dharma comes in the front. And the second understanding is that Krishna was actually a fighter for justice. He was not just a witness, as we always know, that Krishna is Paramatma. He's a witness in the heart. But he always doesn't act just as a witness. He sometimes gets into action. Just like in the Mahabharata war, Krishna had taken a vow never to fight. You know, he would never to take up a weapon. But then, when he found that Arjuna was almost dying, Bhishmadeva was too powerful. And on that day, he was almost going to kill Arjuna. So Krishna decided, this is too much. Enough of being a witness. Now I have to get into action. So he lifts up a wheel and actually charges towards Bhishmadeva to kill him. And if Arjuna had not stopped him, he might have probably actually killed Bhishmadeva. So Krishna, he is actually a fighter for justice. He is not just a witness. And then the third thing is that Krishna is a divine teacher. He is not just always a person who is acting, but he is also somebody who imparts knowledge, brahmanical. So he taught that the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna, which is the song of God. And another concept is that he was a reformer, in the sense that he actually dealt against many social, you know, injustice that was done in society. And his role mainly was to remove corruption and such things. One of the instances where he acted in the role of a social reformist is where he went to the 16,000 queens who were captured by Banasura and kept in one palace. So when Krishna killed him, he actually released the 16,000 women, 16,000 young princes. And all of them approached Krishna with a social problem. The social problem was that now they were misfit in society. They said, who's going to accept us now? So Krishna, he acted as a social reformist. And he actually married all the 16,000 women. So this is another aspect of Krishna. And another aspect is that Krishna was actually somebody who made systems. He himself explains in the Bhagavad Gita, Chaturvarnam Maya Shrishtam. He says, the four varnas and the four ashramas are something that is the brainchild of Krishna. It's something that Krishna originated. Or Krishna manifested. So this is a practical, Varanashram is a practical and a realistic approach to dealing with society. Even now, this fight is always there. Which is better? Capitalism, communism, you know, or so many isms. But there is no understanding of what is the right attitude. What should be the right approach towards society. But Prabhupada, when he went to Russia, dealing with the communist society, he said, communism has to fail. Why? Communism means everybody is equal. And Krishna speaks about Varna and Ashram. He talks about differentiation based on actions and differentiation based on nature. So that's basically what is Varna Ashram. So when you equate everybody as equal, then it creates turmoil and it creates unbalance in society. That's why communism completely collapsed. So when you follow the rules and the systems made by Krishna, it actually, the whole thing makes perfect sense. And of course, there are so many more things that we can analyze of how Krishna has played different roles. So he has played the role of a friend, of a true son by getting all the six children of Devaki back and so many other things. So we'll not get into that. But in conclusion, we can conclude by understanding that this concept of the Gita, which is teaching us these three concepts of karma, jnana and bhakti, is a wholesome concept. And when practiced with the right guidance and with the right attitude, can lead to perfection. And it will help us to elevate or to transcend this world and actually achieve the spiritual realm. But without guidance, the same knowledge can actually act as a very powerful tool to elude us completely, to bewilder us completely. Many people ask, why do I need somebody, why do I need a guru or a spiritual master or a guide to reach God? Why can't I develop my own unique relationship with God? I am a son of God, right? Everybody says, I am a son of God. So why can't I develop my own relationship with God without anybody's intervention in between? The understanding is that when we have these different personalities in between us and God, our concept of God actually becomes better. Just like in a telescope, the object of the telescope is actually to see something very far away, clearly. But then, to see something very far away clearly, we have to look through the lens of the telescope. And the further the object is away from us, that many lenses are needed in between our eyes and the object. So the telescope is made up of series of lenses, many, many lenses put together. So it might seem that if I see through the lenses, so many things are coming between me and that planet. So, you know, when we are seeing astronomically, it might seem that so many barriers are coming between me and that planet or that object what we're seeing. But actually, if you analyze it, every lens is actually making our vision of that planet or that object more and more and more clear and more crystal clear. So every personality that comes between us and God, who is giving us the right understanding, is actually helping us understand God better and better and better. So guru, the concept of guru or spiritual master or a guide in our life, is actually somebody who can actually clarify and crystallize our vision of God, crystallize our channel to approaching God. So in business, we call this person a capitalist. Just like when you're doing a business dealing, you find a capitalist who will help you invest your money, or if you don't have money, he will give you the money to invest in the right place. So for us, the concept of a guide or a guru is that capitalist who helps us invest in the right place. So, and the other concept is that many people in this world think that having many servants is what we want to achieve, is the position that we want to achieve in life. But the understanding that is given in Bhagavad Gita by Krishna is that having many masters is what we want to achieve in life. Because every master helps us to understand God better. And just to conclude with, God should actually be the center of our lives. And when God is actually the center of our lives, all the eccentricities of our life get centered, get taken care of when God is in the center. And to get God back to the center, what it takes is the concluding section of the Gita, where Krishna talks about Sarva Dharman Parityajya Mam Ekam Sharanam Vraja. Krishna offers himself to somebody who actually takes shelter of him. And to conclude with a small story which will drive in this concept of taking shelter of God, and to drive in this concept of how God is actually center of our lives. There was a man who went to a saintly person, and he asked the saintly person that, you know, he served the saintly person very nicely. So this saintly person was very happy with this man. And he wrote a note. You know, on a note, he wrote a number one. And he gave this number one, the note, to this man. And he said, as long as you have this note, every day you will get 1 rupee. And that 1 rupee will suffice you for your whole day. And the next day you'll get another rupee. So this man had faith in the words of this saintly person. And he went ahead in life. And then every day, somehow or the other, he would get 1 rupee. And at that time, that point of time, 1 rupee was a very big amount of money. So with that 1 rupee, he would get enough vegetables and grains to nourish himself, and he would have more. So he would always use that surplus money to serve another saintly person. So like this, he went on for many days. And then at some point of time, he met another saintly person who was very happy with the attitude that he had. And he took his note and he wrote a 0 after the 1. So it became now 10 rupees. So every day after that day, he was getting 10 rupees. And he used the 10 rupees to serve even more people. So this way it went on and on. Then he met a third person who wrote another 0. And he made it 100 rupees. And then this man became so proud that he was becoming richer and richer. Of course, he was serving many more people, but he was becoming proud also. And then he went back to his guru, to his saintly, to that original saintly person, and he told him, see, my master, I've earned so much more. And he showed him that note of 100 rupees, 100, which is written. And his master simply took his pen and scratched off the one. And he said, now what is the value of these two zeros? So the point is, God in our lives always plays the central role of one. And without God, without the understanding and intervention of God in our lives, where it's filled with many zeros, however many is irrelevant. Because one or multiple is the same thing, is insignificant. So, with this understanding, I would like to end with a request that tomorrow being Gita Jayanti, you all could take up this understanding and study of the Gita as importantly and as a most relevant aspect of your life and actually perfect your life. Thank you very much. If anybody has any questions or comments or clarifications, we can end here. Can I ask him? So ultimately, it's a very nice question. The question was that many leaders of society like Mahatma Gandhi and so many others followed or talked about the concept of violence, of non-violence. And Krishna many times introduces the concept of violence. So the understanding is that which is given in the Gita and which we understand through the Acharyas is that what is of supreme importance is what actually pleases Krishna. Many people ask Prabhupada this question. Why Krishna talks about fighting? You know, when he is God. Right? So the understanding is that what Krishna wants is what is relevant to our lives. And at some point of time, both the parties ultimately want the same thing. Ultimately want dharma to be established. Ultimately want time and space to practice what we really want to practice. Like, why the freedom fighters were fighting or were trying to achieve freedom or independence? The reason was that so that they could comfortably and happily practice the spiritual lives. And the reason Krishna intervened in the whole battle of Kurukshetra and he wanted the Kauravas eliminated was that so that the Pandavas could comfortably and happily practice their religion, their dharma, without devotion to Krishna. So ultimately both the parties wanted the same thing. But at that point of time where Krishna, it's not that Krishna opted for war as the first means. Krishna tried everything else. In fact, Yudhishthira Maharaj even proposed to Duryodhan, that just give us 5 tracts of land, 5 villages. That's enough for us. But when all that was almost impossible, when all that was rejected by Duryodhan, and they very clearly made a statement that Duryodhan in fact said, I will not give as much land as is there when you drop a pin. How much land is there on a pinhead, even that much land I will not give. So when Duryodhan declared that, then there was no other go except the war. So ultimately when we see it, we should not see it just from the superficial point of view of violence or not violence. We should see it from the point of view of what God wants. So when Krishna, who is God himself, is coming and saying, I want this, then choosing anything else is mundane morality. Morality is great. But morality, when it contradicts with the desire of the Lord, is not great. Right? Is it making sense? When morality is against the desire of the Lord, that's not of much relevance to us. So what we are concerned is with what Krishna wants. So ultimately we are concerned with pleasing Krishna. So when the freedom fighters of the past actually exercised their will and desired the freedom in that way, they managed to get it. But then that's the way they wanted it. But in the Bhagavad Gita, when you compare it, you can't make two comparisons, because these are two different contexts and two different personalities involved and two different desires involved. So the desire of the Lord was very clear in the case of Arjun. There was a clear instruction to Arjun, take up your arms and fight. So Krishna, Arjun's act of violence was actually the greatest act of non-violence, because he was following the instructions of Krishna. Right? And ultimately, each of those soldiers who fought in the war on both the sides got ultimate benefit. Because it is described that every soldier who fought on the battlefield, ultimately, what was the last thing that he saw? He saw Krishna sitting on the chariot. And with that vision of the Lord, they died. So all of them ultimately achieved perfection in their lives. So for them, that war was a means to release them from the bondage of this world. Right? So that's the understanding that we have, I hope. So in our case, it depends on who we are and what is our role in society. So if we have a certain role in society where we have to implement violence, so that's the service to society. But if you have a role in society where we can follow the teachings of the Lord without any violent means, we should do it. Right? So it depends on what role we play in society. Right? So basically it is on an individual basis that we decide. It's not a general principle. But the general principle is definitely there. The general principle is whatever is needed to please the Lord and follow the instructions of the Lord, that is relevant. And for our individual selves, we should take guidance and understand what is relevant for us in our life to follow. Otherwise, we'll always be caught in this conception of morality and religion. You know, so we should always take the guidance of the right people. Right? Thank you very much. We're getting late now. So we'd like to end over here. Thank you for your kind attention. Grantara Srimad Bhagavad Gita ki jai. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.